TruthJihad.com. Okay, today's show features, well, our first guest here is Tony Gosling from the UK. Tony has been doing research on alternative topics for longer than I have to admit. And so we've got a whole lot to talk about. He's a Bilderberg watcher, and so we can go back over whether or not the Bilderbergers declared that they're going to have World War III this year. It's always a good thing to keep an eye on, and more. So let's get at it. Hey, welcome, Tony. How's it going?
Also, just one quick thing. Thanks, Kevin, for asking me on again. Is this whole thing about the jihad, it doesn't get said enough, because they repeat this nonsense on the TV over here and the radio, and as I know they do in the States again and again, this whole, listen, Christians, you have a hymn, I think it's a Methodist hymn, actually, called Onward Christian Soldiers. This is right across all the monotheistic faiths. I'm not sure about the others, but this idea that you're fighting spiritual warfare is there. You know, our grandparents and our grandparents' grandparents would have recognized this very, very clearly, and it's all being steered into this, just any excuse to demonize those of faith. And I don't think that, you know, the Muslims are the only people in history. I seem to remember back in 1945 there was a whole other bunch of people in the monotheistic faith that also got targeted, Kevin.
Right. Well, you know, you could also argue that it's not really the faith that's the issue. Karen Armstrong has that book out. I think it's her most recent book still, about the question of violence and religion. And she does a pretty good job of showing that there's really not much of a connection, and you don't have to really even read her book to understand that sense.
Well, you won't be seeing her on the BBC then.
Probably not, no. That's true. It seems like the New World Order propaganda network that runs the mainstream media is convinced that we need to move towards a brave new secular world order. But since religion declined, and it was pretty well in decline among the elites by the 19th century, and Wilson's book, God's Funeral, covers that topic. And so by the end of the 19th century, the Western elites didn't believe in God anymore. And did that bring in a new era of peace, love, and understanding in the 20th century? Not hardly. Those same secularist elites butchered far more people than ever before, far more so than their religious predecessors ever did. So, you know, I think, Tony, this idea that religion is tied in with warfare and violence is really the product primarily of this weird Western history, especially of the wars of religion of the 16th century in particular. You know, that was a very, very bloody century, and we remember that as, you know, the Catholics slaughtering Protestants and vice versa. And that sort of imprinted on our consciousness by way of the Lumières, the Enlightenment, that religion is all about war. But, of course, it's not. And if you stop and look at history objectively, you realize that, if anything, it's gotten worse since religion has declined.
Well, it's almost like one of the main parts of religion now should be understanding and resisting propaganda and lies, which is why it's so lovely to be on No Lies Radio. But look, you got me, didn't get on me on here to talk about this. You got me on to talk about the Bilderbergers.
The Bilderbergers!
Well, they are, aren't they a fascinating bunch? Well, when I started looking into them, it was 1996 when I first heard of them, and I was given this name Bilderberg by, I think it's probably fair to call him a kind of constitutional activist, a guy who happened to be a violinist as well, and has written books about the violin, and has been an orchestral conductor, etc. And I thought, well, let's go away and have a look at this. But my goodness, what a gold seam of conspiracy and intrigue this group is. They do really do seem to be the main, literally, public facing, because they're you can just about see that these people do exist at these conferences. You can look through the bars and see them. Sometimes they wander out bizarrely outside the police cordon and just sort of kind of walk around amongst general public, which you don't sort of scratch your head and think, well, what on earth was that police cordon for if they're just going to waltz outside and just walk around? But the fact of the matter is, these people absolutely revel in their anonymity. The fact that they never give mainstream media interviews, very, very rarely, almost always will decline those interviews. So eventually the mainstream press just give up asking them. I'm talking about, you know, the kings and the princes and the queens and your Kissinger types. And if they do, they do it on their own terms. So there isn't any real proper journalism when it comes to the Bilderberg. And of course they have the journalists in there from Financial Times, The Economist, New York Times, Washington Post, etc., all these major news outlets from right around the NATO countries. Frank Werther, Allgemeine Zeitung, found out something quite interesting about that this time, and I was so glad that I went. And Kevin, I cannot encourage audience enough to come along to these conferences to see for yourself, particularly because Dresden is such a fascinating city historically, with the bombing in World War II, and of course well before that being the capital of Saxony in the 1500s, one of the great capitals of Europe, one of the, you know, amazing city architecturally. I mean, not necessarily my this Rococo style with this loads of embellishments and decoration and lots of statues of what appear to be Greek and Roman gods. Atlas, you know, features big style there. Not really my style. I think it looks a bit ugly and garish, kind of kitsch, really. But, you know, certainly interesting place to be. But then the other side of it is that you're in a Taschenberg Palace Hotel, which is right in the public highway, you know. So, you know, you can be there, right, you know, take photographs right in their face. And it just so happened that there's a lovely cafe overlooking the entrance to where the conference was. So we were able to sort of sit around this beautiful cafe in the sunshine and just photograph and watch as the Bilderbergers went in and out.
That sounds like a lot of fun for a Bilderberg spotter. Don't you kind of wish Henry Kissinger would wander out and you could just arrest him for war crimes?
Well, of course, you do suggest this to the police, and the German police don't have the sense of humour that the British police had when they were in Watford a few years ago. But the one copper did say to me, a German guy, that, oh, so that means there's no point in voting. He didn't even look surprised. Which is worrying, isn't it? That's the sort of culture we've got to now. People are kind of so disengaged from politics that they don't, they might do their vote, but they don't expect it to change anything. And that's exactly how the Bilderbergers love it. You know, you have given up really with the political system because we have taken it over. I did get a chance to meet face to face a couple of Bilderbergs this time after they came walked out. I think it was on the Saturday, and you know, I approached James A. Johnson. Actually, he was on the Sunday night, and as soon as I mentioned the word Brexit, you could see it's, you know, almost like an electric rod up his backbone, and he hated it. He didn't want to think about it, talk about it. And then he started getting angry, shouting at me, saying this is a private place when we were in the middle of this beautiful square in Dresden. He was actually sitting in a cafe. And he just, this is the way these things go, is these people just expect that they can be the people that control most of the power and the money in politics and finance and media in the Western world, and yet people won't even notice them in the street. They love it that way. I also met...
Wait a minute. Is there any mainstream media coverage now? Because I know for years there was a total blackout, and now it seems like there's a little bit.
There's a lot more than there used to be, which isn't saying much. But certainly when I first started covering this in, what was it now, in the year 2000, I went to my first Bilderberg conference, although I started putting lists up on the internet. I think I'm right in saying, yes, I was the first person to put full lists of Bilderberg attendees up on the internet. That was the lists for 1995 and 96, which I did in 96 on a little website, and which then swiftly got overwhelmed with hits. And ever since then, it's increased generally just bit by bit. And I think it's pretty clear what Bilderberg is. It's not really a place where big decisions are made. Those big decisions are made by the steering committee elsewhere. And they have other meetings in between, although, they lie about that. They deny it.
Now, do we know where those other meetings are?
Yeah, sometimes, yes. I mean, occasionally people stumble across them. Sometimes there are leaks. I know in Italy a few years back there was a leak in the Italian papers that this was a Bilderberg steering committee meeting going on around about December time. And funnily enough, the last December, there were suddenly, all of a sudden, kind of big changes on the steering committee. Now, you're not telling me that there wasn't a meeting that decided those changes. You know, that someone has just decided that, I'm just trying to think who moved. All I can remember right now is that it was Eric Schmidt moved in to take over, I think, the slot of David Rockefeller on the steering committee. And who else was it? Maybe Peter Thiel. But anyway, it was very much a shift away from finance and towards, I mean, I suppose if the financial system's going down the tubes, then that may be why they're thinking we need to be looking ahead of that. And Google a TO, I'm not quite sure what his company's called, but obviously he's financing loads of these new big tech startups that end up taking over, like PayPal, Facebook, all these kind of things. And so these are the guys that they're shifting into the key positions. But that sort of thing doesn't just happen at Bilderberg by accident. There's been another meeting to decide that. So there's lots of evidence that the meetings do take place. So the Bilderberg conference itself is a schmooze fest where they get the kings and the queens down, who obviously they're in touch with anyway, because these people have massive shareholdings. Certainly the British royal family is massively invested in the City of London, in land right across Britain and the old Commonwealth. Absolutely, you know, millions of acres of land. And they are massive wealth. They're very, very interested in, I mean, also things like Shell, the Royal Dutch Shell, and the big shareholdings in these that the royals have. So these are big players too, but they schmooze. They're looking for the new and up and coming political leaders. What they're doing is that they're going through some of the people who maybe prove themselves a little bit ruthless in one way or another and quite good in front of a camera. And they're like Tony Blair was in the early 1990s and Bill Clinton, you know, with his saxophone, swinging that around and swinging his hips and, you know, looking like the sort of guy that might win an election. And that's all they're interested in.
Looking for front men, yeah. But also, don't they set some policy or talk about policy?
I would say vetting. Well, of course, they're listening very, very closely to what they say. But, you see, you know, social climbers are very good at picking up on what they're supposed to think and thinking it conveniently for their patrons, and that's exactly what happens at these conferences, is these people are basically pliable stooges who will just take on any kind of idea, any kind of whatever, if they think that it'll help them to get ahead and it will ingratiate themselves to their, you know, Wizard of Oz patrons behind the scenes. So I mentioned briefly the stuff to do with the first Bilderberg meeting, and a guy I met there called Klaus Kopf. And, you know, when I first started in 1996 putting these lists up online, I came across a guy there it was the first time he'd ever been to a Bilderberg conference. He's a young German student in the mid-1990s, and I remember some very brief email communication with him at the late 90s. And so I bumped into him there for the first time ever. It just so happened, well, I mean, it was his first one. It was the first international Bilderberg I'd been to for many years. I should kick myself, really, because I should go to these things. But he explained how he'd first come across them in 1995. So, I thought, well, I'd better buy you a beer, you know. He first discovered them a year before I did. I mean, there were others doing this work beforehand. But a lot of it, I'm afraid to say, Kevin, was quite, had a real nasty anti-Semitic tinge to it. I'm, you know, afraid to say that.
Yeah, yeah. I think I remember John Ronson's book on them, Adventures with Extremists, involved him talking to some early Bilderberg watchers, and some of them were convinced that all the Bilderbergers were Jewish. And then John Ronson was saying, "Well, look, look at all these names. No, these, you know, hardly any of them are Jewish." And then the guy would say, "Well, that's just because they're all, you know, crypto Jews or something like that." So yeah. John Ronson was making a big
well,
deal.
What
out
we
of that.
Tried to do, I think, in the mid '90s was to try and look beyond all that and to see this as a, you know, a newsworthy event where you get, you know, the richest and most powerful together in the same place. Surely there should be cameras all over the place, particularly when they're wandering around and journalists have got the opportunity to grab interviews, even if that interview happens to be the person turning around and running away on their heels with some of the real movers and shakers, like the James A. Johnson I mentioned. I mean, he's, you know, Goldman Sachs, he's the bagman for Hillary Clinton, and he was the bagman for Obama. I mean, this guy is one of the lowest people on the planet. He's the man who what he tries to do is a kind of interface between the financial obsession networks, you know, people who are just, all they want to do is accrue more and more and more financial wealth far beyond their wildest dreams that they could ever spend or, you know, use in this kind of obsessive, actually manic fashion, and use that wealth to throw absolutely any amount of money at getting a specific candidate elected, whether that includes suicides, killings. I mean, I won't say murder because we're not sure about that. But what's been going on with giving Clinton the Democratic nomination is nothing short of utter despotism.
Yeah, people talk about the Clinton death list.
Well, yes, certainly the Clinton crime family. I mean, a great pity to see that Victor Thorne has gone, one of the great investigative journalists on the Clinton crime family. And, you know, the idea that you're going to put the Clinton crime family in the White House just is, shows just how far our democracies are going from democracy, absolutely millions of miles away. And so James A. Johnson was an interesting guy to come across, if I can, I wouldn't say meet. It was just, he's rude, aggressive, I would say ignorant. I mean, just, you know, he doesn't have the time of day to pass with you. You know, this guy would rather have a shouting match than just say yes or no and have a, you know, beginnings of a conversation. Not interested whatsoever. And just basically lying about, you know, it being a public place, you know, but a private place is what he said. We're in a public place. What are you talking?
You were in a cafe, and he claimed.
Well,
it was
we were out in the square, in the cafe square, yeah, and I just walked over to him.
Well, I guess he thinks they own everything now, public, private, it's all.
Maybe
private.
He does. Maybe, who knows? Maybe he owns it.
It is getting to that point almost.
Yeah, good, yeah.
So this was Dresden, right?
This is in
yeah, Dresden. I mean, isn't that ironic? This is probably the worst war crime of World War II, some would say, certainly right up there with Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the alleged Nazi death camps and all these terrible things that happened during World War II. Dresden, you know, a lot of people say that was maybe the worst because it was so, well, it was like Nagasaki. It was not a military target at all. It was Germany's most cultural city with nothing military whatsoever. And they just firebombed it and, you know, burned 100,000 people.
Okay, Kevin, I mean, we can get into that, but there was some evidence, well, a lot of evidence that it was a railway hub and that it was a communication center. So there were some excuse for, you know, I mean, of course.
For massacring the entire town and burning them to death?
Well, you know, for taking out the railway junction, you know, that's what I'm saying. But, you know, yes, it was a war crime, of course it was. As is going on right this minute by the British, and the Saudis in Yemen, you know, right this very second, bombs are falling there on civilians, on schools, hospitals, children. So,
and the Bilderbergers are sitting and talking about it quite calmly, plotting out their next mass murder.
No, I mean, as I say, I think these conferences simply are this basically a vetting process for up and coming politicians. They're bringing in, you know, various bits of new blood. There was a couple of British MPs, a British MP, various others, you know, potential business people that they think they might want to back. And if everyone agrees, and if Kissinger goes and sits next to them and puts his arm around them, everyone gets the sign and the signal that this is the great new company or the great new leader. There was some talk about the German defense minister, who's a woman. Can't remember her name right now, but apparently she sat next to Kissinger through the Saturday dinner, and everyone was saying, right, well, she's taking over from Merkel then, you know. So this is what happens at these. It's very feudal, Kevin, very feudal. It's like a kind of medieval court with emphasis on the evil.
Definitely so. So what did you get the sense of being their big policy thing for this year? Typically they have, you know, several themes, and some people, you know, try to read the tea leaves to see what might be coming in the next year based on Bilderberger themes. And this year, of course, a lot of people are concerned about, you know, war escalating, you know, possibly even a kind of a nuclear World War III with the West versus Russia kind of thing. And we're seeing a lot of things heating up in Syria right now. Did you get a sense from the Bilderberger meeting that they're, you know, getting ready to burn down the world, or will they wait a few years first?
Well, certainly this crash is coming, isn't it? I mean, one of the things we did notice was that the finance ministers were going around the back way. They didn't want to be seen. None of the European finance ministers came in the front way. They didn't want to be seen, you know, and associated with the Bilderberg conference. So it does make you wonder whether they're just looking a little bit ahead there, thinking, well, if there is some kind of financial disaster this year, the last thing we want is to have pictures of us all together at this Bilderberg, you know, going in. And they were going in the tradesman's entrance, Kevin. You know, these are the top finance people of Britain, you know, not Britain, actually, no. Several, I think it's Swedes, Austrians, and going in down into the car park and then coming up the kind of, I don't know, it's probably not a service lift, but, you know, that sort of entrance to a marvellous hotel like that is, you know, you're going down a peg or two. So there's something going on there about you know, what they want, what pictures they want out and which they don't. The other sense I got from it is we've had this for years, but we're definitely going high tech. One of the signs I would say is you never quite know until after the meeting what's happened. And I would point people to a BBC Radio 4 program that came out about a month after the conference. Well worth a listen, just because this is Bilderberg speaking. Yeah, it's got no Bilderberg name tag on it, no meta tag on it saying this is a Bilderberg announcement, but it's Martin Wolf, who was in the conference, doing a program with the BBC about the actual title of it. And of course the BBC, as they love to do, and I'm so disgusted by the way they do this, is they put it online and then they pull it off after a few weeks. And so I'm not sure about others, but I've certainly made sure that there are copies still available up on YouTube and on various sort of file sharing sites, MP3 audio sites. And the program's called How Low Can Rates Go? And he's looking at the financial situation. They're using this as a way to end cash. As the interest rates go down and down and down and go into negative interest rates, so you put your £100 in the bank and you go back in a few weeks' time, it's only £99 in the bank, the obvious thing to do is to keep cash. And people will be doing that. And what they're trying to do is make sure they don't. And so they're now talking about rolling out less and less use of cash around Europe. And he's doing this openly in this with the chief policy officer at the Bank of England, is Martin Wolf. So well worth a listen if you want to get a kind of Bilderberger's eye view of how the future should be. Now, I don't think they're necessarily going to get away with this. The abolition of cash is obviously moving us further and further and further towards this biblical Catherine Albrecht has talked about so regularly. I'm not sure if you've had her on your program.
No, you're talking about the mark of the beast.
That's right. Yeah. This is a microchip, which is, at the moment, that microchip is sitting in our debit cards and credit cards, and it's being migrated step by step. I mean, we went away, didn't we, from accepting signatures with a credit card. Now it's just a chip and pin with a credit card. The next stage is the contactless, so there's no actual identity saying this is me, and that's happening, that's being rolled out as well. We're getting further and further away from the idea of money actually being of any kind of value. It's becoming like what was actually the system in ancient Egypt, which is a system of credit, basically. So it's an inventory of everybody in the country and how much credit they've got kept in the center.
You know, Philip K. Dick predicted this in his novels. He had people using POS-creds, or positive credits.
A lot of sci-fi people did, didn't they? But this is there, you know, in black and white, in Revelation, for anybody that cares to look. And it is all about basically having this little microchip inside you, in your hand, in the fleshy bit between your thumb and your forefinger on your right hand is where, supposedly, that's what the Bible talks about. And you have to use it to buy and sell. Now, hang on a minute. How would you get rid of cash? Well, I know what you can do. You can bring interest rates down to negative interest rates. Everyone wants to have their cash, but then what you have to do with the banking system is you've got to actually somehow abolish it.
Right, but that sounds like that's the wrong order, because if you first...
Well, what I'm saying is that we're not on the negative interest rates. I don't know about the US, but we're not there yet. So what they're going to try and do is abolish this cash stuff before we get there. I mean, that's... You know, it seems to me to be the obvious next.
Right, they would have to try to get you out of cash before they do the negative interest rates.
Yeah, and so that's where what they're really talking about in this BBC documentary from Martin Wolf. So if I hear Martin Wolf saying something, I think, well, this is what Kissinger's thinking, and this is what he wants the world to know. So I mean,
that's interesting
just
stuff.
A couple of kind of tidbits from stuff that we've garnered this year, and also fascinating conversations around the conference from various different participants, including this guy Klaus Kopf, I mentioned, the political science student. He's now full-time work, obviously. He's doing other stuff. He's not actually working in political science, but keeping a very, very close eye on everything and getting lots of photographs of all those Bilderbergers to put up online and sell to newspapers and things. But he said some really interesting stuff because he'd done some digging around the very first ever Bilderberg conference in 1954, and at that meeting at that conference, he had a list of the names of the people who were there at the first, the Germans who attended the first Bilderberg meeting. And he'd figured out who a few of them were. There was this one guy, all it said next to his name was lawyer. And he couldn't, it was quite a common name. And he couldn't figure out who he was or why he would be there just as a lawyer. And after a little bit of digging, he realized that this guy was actually the founder of the main newspaper. They don't all come from Berlin, like the British press all comes from London. In Berlin, it's pretty much scattered around, around the country. And this is the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, which is one of the most well-respected, if not the most well-respected newspaper in Germany. This guy was the founder back in the 1950s. And he was just interested in who it was that came and sort of invited him along to these meetings, which is a great bit of work by political scientists. Absolutely brilliant. Klaus has done an amazing job on this. And he managed to, although this guy died long ago, he managed to contact her secretary, who's still alive. His secretary is still alive. And the secretary explained that it was weird that he'd asked about the Bilderberg, because it had always puzzled her when she was working for him. It was the only correspondence that she was never allowed to see, hardly allowed to touch. All she was allowed to do was put it in the safe and lock it up, and never to open any of the envelopes or anything. But she said, there's one thing that I can remember about it, which always stuck in my mind. At the first meeting, the Bilderberg meeting, these two guys came into the office to invite him to go to the meeting a couple of weeks before, basically to tell him to go to the meeting a couple of weeks before. One of them was the head of the new, well, basically their version of MI5 or the FBI, the security service. I think they call it the guardianship of the Constitution Office or something like that in Germany, in the new West Germany as it was then. In fact, it was very, very early stages in the development of the post-war German state. So that was the boss of the Secret Service. And the other guy was Cardinal Frings. Sorry, no, not Cardinal. Archbishop Frings. He was the Archbishop of Cologne, the head of the church, German church. And the appearance of the church there does, you know, for me immediately rings alarm bells. What the hell are the church doing? I mean, inviting people to the first Bilderberg meet. And this, I think, smacks of this Masonic kind of attitude, mm-hmm. where they've got to have, they have this two-pronged approach, don't they? The Masons, they have this idea that they must control politics, they must control the head through politics, and they must control the heart through religion. And that just struck me as a fascinating insight into how these people that are the big power brokers, the interface between the military-industrial complex and politics and finance today in the Western world. They basically run the Western world, these people.
Yeah, it's kind of a club, and you know, an invitation-only club. And I think there are all sorts of networks, you know, one example of the church networking with some pretty nasty parts of the deep state would be the Vatican money laundering for CIA drug money. It turns out the Vatican was the single biggest money laundry for drug money throughout the Cold War era.
Well, I don't know, HSBC seemed to have been catching up and overtaking them almost.
Yeah, well, of course, the Vatican wasn't the only one. But, you know, we're at the end of our half hour. Did you want to continue, or yeah, should we call it a half hour?
Let's have a quick look at the British Labour Party, because that whole business, Kevin, what's happening over here is absolutely fascinating.
Right, yeah, Jeremy Corbyn is kind of the British Bernie Sanders, only better. He really seems to be actually threatening certain corrupt parts of the status quo. Are we going to see Tony Blair on trial for war crimes anytime soon?
Well, that's possible under Corbyn. And, of course, the entire establishment is very, very rattled. I think it's even possible that the poor guy may be killed. Maybe bumped off, because
he took out Michael Meacher, right?
Well, we don't know about Michael Meacher, but you know, there are a lot of people in this country, particularly Robin Cook, who was the Foreign Secretary, who resigned at the time of the Iraq War. John Smith in the early 1990s, who was a Labour Party leader. There are big questions over what happened to them. Tony Benn was a big figure in the Labour left, and just as he was running to be, I think, deputy leader of the party, just sort of one step away from taking it over. He suddenly drank a cup of tea that made him very, very sick for 2 weeks. You know, so there's all sorts of nasty stuff goes on over here, particularly in the left. But Corbyn has got amazing support. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people have joined the Labour Party in the last six, eight, maybe months or so since he became leader. And there seems to be a kind of political resurgence going on. The attempts to kick him out, to bully him out, have just failed one after the other after the other. And I think what's going to happen is when the Labour leadership contest, which is completely pointless because Corbyn's going to win it. He won it so resoundingly last year. There was very little point in it even taking place, apart from that it fills up column inches and airtime with anti-Corbyn statements. I mean, that seems to be the only purpose of this. When that happens, it's pretty clear. Paul Mason, former BBC, father of Chappell, by the way, he was the head of our union at the BBC. He was a financial correspondent on Newsnight, the flagship programme, and he's now freelancing. He has pointed out that there's a whole load of stuff coming. When Corbyn wins this Labour leadership race, as it looks he will, there's going to be legal challenges for the assets, etc., of the Labour Party by the big financial backers of the Labour right. That is, people like Peter Mandelson, who was very, and basically the by the Blairites. They're going to try and take the Labour Party off the 300 or so thousand members who have voted for Corbyn. So this is how, you know, there's basically political sabotage, Kevin, going on, which makes me really wonder about what's happening in the autumn this year. If there's these massive efforts going on to sabotage any kind of democratic politics, as there obviously is over in the US, and this is going on here.
Where were they unable to sabotage the Brexit vote? It looked like that one was going to go down to defeat, and then suddenly, you know, rather, the Brexit was behind by several points in the polling the night before, and somehow.
Well, that's only if you believe the polls. I mean, I think, you know, it wasn't a massive margin, but it was a pretty resounding victory for Brexit, and it's a very strong signal, and the Bilderbergs don't like it. But look, there's other parties here as well. There's UK Independence Party, which was really behind that whole referendum effort, in saying, well, basically, look, if the Conservative Party don't have a referendum, then all these people will leave the Tories and they'll join UKIP and start a new party. So there was a lot of pressure on Cameron and the promises that he'd made when he became leader to deliver that referendum. But UKIP is also in total meltdown, sabotage, I would say. The three main potential leaders for UKIP have all been ruled that they're not allowed to stand for all sorts of different spurious reasons.
Ruled by whom? By people within the party?
By UK Independence Party's national executive have said, no, you can't stand, you can't stand, you can't stand. And you know, so they've basically got a whole bunch of, like, losers standing to be the winner of the leader of the UK Independence Party to take over from Nigel Farage. In the Conservative Party, we've got a complete establishment stitch-up with Theresa May, with her bankster husband, investment banker husband, and a whole load of investment bankers. There's a couple of really good articles on this one, Kevin, if you have a look online, about the amount of money people, Bilderberger types, in the Theresa May cabinet. And, you know, so there is no real democracy at all. We've also got, at the background to all of this, last year's general election here, last time I looked, it was 17, it may be 19 now, MPs could be there illegally, because there's been massive overspends by the Conservative Party in campaigning in key marginal constituencies to swap them over from Labour or Liberal Democrat to Tory, that money that they'd never declared. So this is, you know, these are serious criminal offences, and that could easily overturn the Conservative fragile majority. So we're on a knife edge, really, and it's not surprising to me to see all these other sabotage operations going on in our political party, but of course very little reporting in those terms in our national press at all, if any. I mean, they look at these things as like little atomised events. You know, the Tory election fraud, oh dear, that's one thing. No possible well-known leader for the UK Independence Party, that's another thing. The attempt to overthrow Corbyn, which is totally pointless and like a kind of form of self-immolation by these so-called Labour Blairite types, who are really just a kind of Trojan horse for neoliberals in the Labour Party, the Mandelsons, the Blairs, these kinds of characters. And, you know, so there is no kind of proper discussion, debate going on, particularly no proper opposition, really, because Labour Party is so embroiled in this leadership debate. The only thing to say positive about it all is that Jeremy Corbyn has attracted massive crowds of thousands of people everywhere he goes. And there's some very embarrassing pictures of open air speeches that Owen Smith, the guy who's standing against him, is doing, with maybe sort of 20 people there, you know? So that's
Well, we had that here with Bernie Sanders versus Hillary. Bernie Sanders had huge crowds. Hillary, you know, had to work very hard to get any crowds, but it didn't help because the voting machines were all rigged. But I suppose they can't rig them to the point of delivering anything to anybody right now running against Corbyn. But, you know, it's really interesting from the perspective of the truth movement over here. You know, we're coming up on the 15th anniversary of 9/11, is there have been reports that Jeremy Corbyn is sympathetic to 9/11 truth. And of course, the mainstream isn't hyping that very much, but that's pretty interesting. And, you know, he was a close friend of Michael Meacher, the deceased 9/11 truther.
I would say also, it was just something I caught on the BBC Daily Politics with Andrew Neil a couple of months ago, a tiny comment by him when he was interviewing David Icke, of all people. And he said something about, you know, he was really, I mean, this is where Icke just drops the ball, you know, continually. And he asked him about, you know, what conspiracies you think of, various conspiracies. And, you know, he's done the same to me, actually. And I'll try and come up with something which is, you know, a little bit more. But anyway, Icke starts talking about the lizards and gets diverted. But actually, Andrew Neil said, well, I think that there may be some credence to some of these theories about, you know, 9/11, etc. And, you know, so that's somebody on mainstream television, a mainstream politics show, in a way kind of shrugging and fessing up that, you know, this 9/11 really does need a proper look at, you know. So that's good, even if it is just the comment of some kind of nobody, really, who's happened to be in this position of power under Rupert Murdoch as editor of the Sunday Times when Murdoch took it over, after Murdoch took it over. And, you know, it's very much a kind of child of Rupert. But still, it's good to have that. And so there are signs that I think in the background, slowly but surely, particularly through the armed forces and here in Britain and the weapons of mass destruction fiasco, there's very little trust either in media or in intelligence services by people who are actually going to go and risk their lives, which is, I think, brings us neatly on to talk briefly about Syria, because I've been doing a bit of digging over the last 2 weeks, Kevin. I mean, it's horrendous. We had two weeks ago, hitting the headlines here in Britain over 2 days, the story of these three poor London schoolgirls, aged between 15 and 16, who were persuaded somehow to get on a plane at Gatwick Airport and fly across to Istanbul. To do whatever, maybe even go on holiday. Goodness knows what, how they were managed to persuade to get on that. But once they got there, they were met by this guy called, I can't remember his first name, something Rashad. And it's all, the thing is, this is all out in the Turkish press, in the English language Turkish press, and in various other places around the world. There's a couple of sites in the US that have done this too. And what we get here in the press is just this terrible story, isn't it? Tragic. These girls are going to Syria, and then they get smuggled from Istanbul down to Syria, and then they get, join the Islamic State. And then they realise they can't leave. And there's a brilliant article in The Guardian about how awful it is for anybody in the Islamic State that decides that they want to leave, and how hideous it is, particularly for schoolgirls that have been whisked down there from London. But what they haven't told you is that this guy, Rashid, is actually working directly for the Canadian Intelligence Service. I think it's the CSIS it's called.
So the Canadian Intelligence Service is kidnapping London schoolgirls deliver to ISIS.
Okay, what they're doing is they are trafficking. I think that's probably the right word to use. Trafficking from Istanbul Airport, at the bus station there, down to there's a city about 40 miles from the border, where they're handed over to another guy who's named, who's a British national. Maybe he's working for MI6. It wouldn't surprise me. And then they're taken down across the border. But it's not, I mean, you may get CSIS on the line, Kevin. You might try them. I don't know if they would speak to you. But you could say to them, well, why are you doing this? He even gives the name of his CSIS handler and describes him, his age, his rough age, colour of his eyes, size, etc. And this guy, Rashed, was a former Syrian colonel in the Syrian army. And he decided, obviously, that he wanted some citizenship in one of these Western countries. And they said to him, well, you can have your Canadian citizenship, but if you've got to do a little job for us, we want you to infiltrate ISIS and get some information. But you know what? He's been doing it for 2 years. They reckon, by looking at his laptop, the Turks, that he probably trafficked around about 150 people from around the Western world down from Istanbul down to the Syrian border. And it's like, the thing that amazes me is that the British media doesn't want to know. They want a big sob story about these poor kids, but they don't want to realise that actually it's Western NATO intelligence that's facilitated the entire trip, that effectively these kids have been, as you said at the start, kidnapped and then handed over to what is effectively one of the most dangerous cults on the planet, who will, once they've sworn their oath of allegiance to Baghdadi, if they even so much as think about not doing what they're told or wanting to leave, then they will be killed. You know, this is where we are now with our hopeless and useless and distorted Western media, is that this is not even of interest. The disappearance of the girls, everyone must be so worried about getting down to Syria, of course, they must. But no interest in the fact that it's actually us that put them in Syria and right. Our taxpayers' money that's doing this job, which is absolutely shocking.
Right. Well, that's actually linked to another story out of the UK recently. Anjem Chowdhury, the jihadi, Al-Qaeda, ISIS representative in London, who's been spouting off and given huge mainstream media megaphones to make as much noise as he wants to try to make Muslims look bad. You know, the guy's obviously an asset of the British intelligence services. And he finally was arrested, I guess, and now they're linking him to a long, long list of supposed terror attacks, you know, real and or false flag.
Now, hang on, because you just said he's obviously an asset of the British intelligence service. Well, certainly the British intelligence services, MI6, are using these people. But I think it's very difficult to tell sometimes whether someone is deliberately working for MI6.
Yeah, he could just be a complete idiot.
Well, yes, but I mean, you can call him an idiot, but there is this kind of seductive, apocalyptic stuff, and it's there in all, the Book of Daniel for the Jews, et cetera, and Revelation and other parts of the Christian Bible. There it is. Many Muslims are tempted to believe that they are there, and they can go down, join Islamic State and bring about this caliphate. Mm. Now, I don't know, exactly what's going to happen in the future. I don't have a crystal ball. I'm not sure at all. All I can tell you is the MI6, the CIA, etc., are milking this stuff as much as they can get. So they're using it as a way to feed their own forces, and they're basically playing in the most evil way possible on these dreams of thousands of, hundreds of years ago, of a great new world to come in the future, which was being talked about in those days. And they're trying to tease this out of the Quran and turn it into, hey guys, it's the most exciting, wonderful thing you can do to join and be part of creating God's kingdom on earth, or whatever it is they're trying to do.
I think there are a lot of people like that. Yeah, you have to, sort of get the cart before the horse here, or get the horse before the cart, rather, and see that there is, in fact, within the Muslim community, a lot of disgruntled, kind of unhappiness about what happened to the various Islamic societies over the past few hundred years of Western colonialism. And nobody asked the world's Muslims if they wanted to abolish the Ottoman Caliphate. It was abolished by, the Young Turk tools of the Rothschilds and the Danmeh, Jewish satanic element that took over Turkey on behalf of international Freemasonry. And the world's Muslims have never wanted this caliphate to be gone, and the polls show that more than two-thirds of Muslims worldwide want the Muslim-majority countries to unite. So this is a very, very widely shared dream. And I think the reason that the bad guys have created ISIS is to skunk this legitimate desire for a united Muslim Ummah. In other words, if you can take this idea of a caliphate or a, you know, united Muslim entity, and you can link it to these crazed, you know, war criminals, these lunatics from ISIS, and these, you know, nut jobs like Anjem Chowdhury, it actually makes the whole project look ludicrous, and it makes it that much harder to build that movement. But, you know, the world's Muslims do want that. And so this is psychological warfare against the world's Muslims to try to prevent us from achieving a united Muslim Ummah.
No, I totally agree with you. Very nicely put. And, this is, I think, the way that the criminal elite love to operate. If you want to call them fascists, if, you know, it doesn't almost matter what you call them. They're certainly criminal. They're prepared to break the law, murder, kill at will thousands of people, destroy civilizations. I mean, look what's happened, for goodness sake, to places like Libya and Iraq. Now it's happening to one of the world's oldest civilizations, really the homeland of the Arab people, one of the first civilizations on the planet, in Yemen. They don't care who they smash, who they destroy, in order to try and bring their plan of a complete balkanization of the Middle East, destroying everything around Israel just to make Israel look like the kind of only place that's left. And I suppose there are some in the United States and the Christian Zionist movement. Thank God there's not so many here in Britain who believe that rubbish, but who somehow think that Israel is doing God's work, which is, you know, this is where I think we get very, very little depth of criticism in the mainstream press about this interface between politics and faith, because we're certainly beginning to look at a kind of a religious war possibly breaking out in the Middle East between, you know, the rightful forces of Islam. I'm not talking about Islamic State, and what the Israelis are doing. And this is almost a kind of fusion of religion and politics. The other thing, of course, is that with this caliphate, you know, I would suggest, just as a basic good idea, that Muslims should be creating lots of caliphates. And who knows, one of them might turn into something really amazing, powerful, and a force for good in the world. And in the meantime, of course, there's still Iran. And, you know, whatever you might say about Iran, they are a very, very stable, you know, they are one of the most stable forces in the region. They're, again, a very old civilization, in a way like the Russians, very used to being invaded, very used to being coming under attack, whether it's psychological attack or any kind of nonsense from the Crusaders in the past, etc. And the, you know, the British playing tricks, trying to, you know, take them over and failing and then going through past and into India, etc. So, you know, there are some civilizations left, I think, which, you know, hopefully will challenge this hegemony in the Middle East, which is just causing utter destruction at the moment. And yet it doesn't seem to almost register on our screens here in Britain, in our media and in our political discourse. It's almost like we've washed our hands of the whole thing.
Right. Well, I think the policy that's being pursued by the empire, and, you know, the empire, you know, whether you say it's headquartered in the city of London or in Washington, D.C., it's still pretty much the same entity. I think it's pursuing a very conscious policy of divide and conquer, and they've been very successful at dividing so-called Sunnis, and that's not the way most people ever thought of themselves. Most people think of themselves as Muslims, and then maybe as, you know, a Maliki or Hanafi or Hanbali or Shafi'i or what have you. But now, post-Iraq, after the U.S. Smashed up Iraq and then handed power to the majority of the people, and the majority there is Shia, and so they, you know, then they started the war between, you know, Sunni and Shia with false flag bombings. They've been stoking this Sunni versus Shia thing, and Saudi Arabia has been all on board with that. And the Israelis, of course, are behind this. It's part of the Oded Yadon plan to divide and conquer the Middle East. But they're really consciously trying to destroy Islamic unity. And as you said, Iran is the most successful Islamic political experiment. And they want to make sure that that doesn't spread. So one of the major benefits from their point of view of this havoc that they're wreaking by creating ISIS and unleashing it and you know, putting out all of this anti-Shia propaganda, brainwashing Sunni Muslims to hate Shia, all of this is designed to make sure that the majority of Muslims in the region don't decide, instead of, you know, beating Iran, to join them and to work on creating their own independent Islamic republics, which could then join together in a kind of federation. So I think that it's not that the empire is just stepping back and watching. I think they're getting involved in a very destructive way.
No, they certainly are. And I mean, this is where I think we could kind of come back to look at the Bilderbergers and the way they operate with these arms companies. I think they've decided that the media is a major target. I mean, we've seen the shutdown of the media here, the closing of investigative journalism since the mid-early 1990s. Nothing really much happening since then at all. And so what that really means is journalism has migrated from something which attempts to show both sides. Now it doesn't even bother to attempt. It is just presenting the official government view. So we're in this kind of Orwellian world where we're supposed to agree with whatever the government says we're supposed to agree with, because the guys at the TV company, even if it is an independent TV company, are biting their nails about whether they're going to lose their franchise or not. And they just kowtow to everything that the government's saying, which is, you know, and we have been driven into the hands, haven't we, of these new Bilderberg oligarchs, that's people like Schmidt, you know, and that you can see what they're doing is they're trying to make sure that they completely control. Now there may be some sort of freedom of speech, or freedom of exchange of information on the internet with all these citizen journalists, but that's actually not what we want. What we want is we want to be able to switch on the TV or listen to the radio, and we want to just be able to get our news from there. Some proper journalism, balanced journalism, professional journalism, which challenges authorities. We're not getting that anymore. So we're being forced online. That means we're being forced into this kind of surveillance net. And that takes me straight back to the Second World War and all the work that went on in Nazi Germany. People didn't know why does Hitler have to keep having all these censuses? Why are we having to give all our information about our faith, our religion, you know, who we are, our names, children, dates, and everything in the run-up to the Second World War? We're just a bit bureaucratic. Well, it wasn't that, was it? What they were doing is they were setting up these massive profiling databases on everybody. And just imagine what those profiling databases look like now, Kevin. I mean, you're talking about the entire planet almost. Well, you know, some parts of...
Well, they've got more data than they probably know what to do with. The real trick now is the algorithms that they use to make sense of all the data that's available.
I mean, I just refer you back to Edwin Black's book, and I'm not sure if you've read that or come across it, but it is, I mean, his work is absolutely wonderful as a Jewish writer on, I think the book's called IBM and the Holocaust, where what he's looking at is just what this massive data trawl by Hitler was all about in the 1930s, was enabling him to just kind of sit there and say, well, this part of society, we're going to get rid of that. We're going to get rid of these people. We're going to carve those people. We're going to divide those people off from those people. And we're going to imprison those people. And we're going to stick those into the labor camps. And so when the Gestapo were in a particular city, wanted to arrest all the Jews or whoever it was, the gypsies or whatever, they knew exactly where they were, where they'd gone, everything about them. Well, quite a lot about them anyway. Nowadays, you know, they know even more. And they are... I think looking, poring over the Bilderbergers I'm talking about, because they're some of the biggest people in the world involved in data mining. And of course, that's basically hacking, you know, stealing data from wherever, from China, Russia, great databases of the population. I would suggest, you know, there's a very, very good case nowadays for being completely off the internet, having nothing to do with any kind of database, not giving your information to the government wherever they ask you for it. Because we're living in a world dominated by this criminal elite now, and so anything you hand to the government under some kind of statute is handed to them. I think there's a, talking to young people here, Kevin, there's a much more awareness of this, and I think I get to meet a particularly prized bunch of youngsters, but you know, they're very, very canny to this. The idea is that the government is something malevolent, dangerous, don't trust it. That these people, you know, would sell your grandmother if it benefited them, and that awareness is a kind of pre-war awareness. So we just have to ask the question, when is this war going to come? And I think it will. You'll get, I think, some kind of... And if imagine what 9/11 was like. I would imagine that the way that worked was that some company, possibly US, maybe British, maybe Israeli, who knows, a private military company of some sort said, look, we can do this, we can arrange that, we can do that. And it may have been through and with state intelligence services, quite obviously they would need that cover, but that heist, if you want to call it that, the 9/11 job, would probably purchased, you know, from one of these private brains. Now, I would say that's what's going on right now, that the various big private military companies, ones that, for example, that boast of being able to fight nuclear wars for you and help you, you know, win a nuclear war, come up with the right strategy to take out nuclear, you know, your opponent in a nuclear war before they can respond. These kinds of firms will be putting together ideas of how to kick that war with Russia off. And the Chinese will probably be standing by the sidelines. But it may be nuclear, it may not. It may just be a conventional war. At which point, this economy, which is sitting on the top of the White Cliffs of Dover, if you want, just teetering there, all it will take is that, and the whole house will come crashing down.
Well, I don't think a conventional war would necessarily stay conventional, of course, because whoever is losing has the incentive to ratchet up to nuclear, and so it could get very, very ugly.
Well, but I think it depends. I mean, if you're fighting the Russians, let's think about this. If you're
we only have about 30 seconds to think about it. So
okay,
give us a short
if you're reason. fighting the Russians in Eastern Europe, I don't think they're going to be out for grabbing loads of territory, but they'll do a very, very powerful defensive war, probably even a better defensive war than the Nazis fought at the end of World War II.
Mm-hmm. That very well could be. And if their defenses, conventional defenses, fail, I don't think they're going to fail to use.
No, I don't think they'll fail. They won't fail. They're very unlikely. Their equipment is far better than ours.
Okay, well, you heard it here first, folks. I hope it doesn't come to that. Okay, well, thank you so much, Tony Gosselin. I appreciate all of the great alternative journalism you've been doing for so long, long before I got involved in this field. Keep it up. Keep up the great work, and we'll have to check in again somewhere down the line.
Okay, cheers, Kevin, and lots of love from the other side of the pond.
Okay, likewise. Take care.